Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
If you have been paying any attention at all, then you don't need me to tell you that the regime's security forces in Iran are not exactly respectful of human rights.
The head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards warned protesters that Saturday would be their last day of taking to the streets.
We will turn up at your door with these very same youth. We will not leave you alone. Know that we will take revenge.
As protests have raged in the country, Iran's Revolutionary Guard has used violent and brutal methods to clear the streets. At the same time, there is credible information that that same guard has been working with Russian forces to attack Ukraine with drones. And there is a long and bloody history before that. But all of that is to ask this question. What does that require Canada to do about it here in our country? Last week, a judge made a decision that the federal government has so far refused to make, despite calls from both sides of the political spectrum, as well as human rights advocates. This judge ruled that Iran's Revolutionary Guard is a terrorist entity. Now, what does that mean? What led an Ontario Superior Court judge to rule on the designation of a foreign police force? And what happens now? Those are all questions we'll try to answer. But perhaps the key question is this one. Why was a judge making this decision and not our federal government? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Stuart Bell is a national online journalist for Global News. He specializes in national security and foreign affairs. Hi, Stuart.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Why don't we start with the basics? What is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard? And, you know, historically, what are they known for?
Well, the Revolutionary Guard was an armed group that was set up after the 1979 revolution in Iran. And its mission was really to defend the new Islamic system of government that was brought into power through that revolution. Mm-hmm. And in particular, to protect it from what they perceive as both their internal and their external enemies. So within the IRG, there's the Basij, which is sort of like a militia that does basic defense and also targets opponents of the regime within Iran. And then there's also another faction called the Quds Force, which specializes more in external or foreign activities. And I mean, what they're known for essentially is promoting the interests and particularly the ideology of the regime, which is centered around the Ayatollah and his, I guess, what you might call a hardline interpretation of his doctrine and what some really would describe as kind of a paranoid worldview, one that's really focused on anti-Western ideas and particularly focused on the U.S. and Israel. And of course, if you're going to mention what they're known for historically, we have to say that in 2020, it was the IRGC that shot down a passenger plane departing Tehran, killing 55 Canadians and 30 permanent residents of Canada.
So I understand that part of the IRGC was designated a terrorist organization, but not the whole thing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The government has listed the Quds Force branch of the IRGC. The Quds Force, as I said, is the arm of the IRGC that engages in external operations, so supporting other violent organizations in the Middle East in particular. But the IRGC itself is not listed. So you have a situation where one faction of the IRGC has been, in effect, criminalized in Canada, where it's illegal to have any dealings with it. But that's not so for the IRGC itself as an organization.
Over the past couple of months, the world's been watching protests on the streets of Iran almost every day. What sorts of things have we seen and heard from the Guard during those protests? You mentioned they're very dedicated to keeping the regime in power. This is the biggest threat the regime has seen in quite some time now.
The IRGC has been demonizing the protesters who've taken to the streets after the death of Mahsa Amini in September. They've labeled the demonstrators as enemies. The IRGC is really part of this crackdown that's taking place, as well as against the Kurdish minority in the country, we should point out. And together with the Iranian law enforcement forces, the IRGC has been very closely implicated in, you know, all of the brutality we've seen in the last few weeks: extrajudicial killings, torture, disappearances of protesters, some of them children. So it's absolutely part of this suppression of protests that's taking place at the moment.
That suppression of the protests and especially the human rights abuses have led to, I would say, calls from around the world for tougher action. And that kind of brings us to what happened in Canada this past week. Can you tell me about the ruling in the Ontario Superior Court? What did the judge decide?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very particular case. It's a very basic case in some aspects. It's simply, there was a Canadian lawyer who worked in Dubai. He's now deceased. A court in Dubai had ordered him to settle an alleged debt with an Iranian aviation company called Soranet. So as people that are owed money do, or in businesses, Soranet went to the Ontario court to try and enforce the debt and get access to his estate. But what's interesting in the larger scale of this case is the judge dismissed it, wouldn't allow Soranet to collect the money in Canada on the grounds that Soranet and its owner were known financiers of the IRGC, and that paying them, settling this debt would have violated Canada's anti-terrorism laws. And the ruling found, and this is where it gets complicated and interesting, but not only did the IRGC meet the definition of a terrorist group, but it was essentially already a listed terrorist group in Canada because the Quds Force was listed. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of thrown a wrench into the whole debate over, you know, what is the IRGC? Is it a terrorist entity? Mm-hmm. Should it be listed, when you have a judge's ruling saying it already is listed?
What does it mean to be declared a terrorist entity in Canada?
Well, the list of terrorist entities is sort of a public way of identifying who Canada considers to be associated with terrorism. And it's not a crime to be on the list, but there are some pretty heavy consequences. I mean, they're really designed to make it more difficult for terrorist groups to operate in Canada. So groups that are on the list, their property can be seized and forfeited.
Okay.
Financial institutions aren't allowed to deal with their property, and it's illegal to participate or contribute, even indirectly, to the activities of any of these groups on the list. It's a way that really puts these groups in a corner and makes it almost impossible for them to operate financially or otherwise.
Here's my big question. Why is an Ontario Superior Court judge making this decision about such a notable group as the IRGC and not the federal government or CSIS or, you know, whomever should have the authority to make that call? It feels like that's a pretty big decision to be coming from a judge in Ontario.
Yeah, well, for whatever reason, the Canadian government has not listed the IRGC. So, I mean, this is something that the interpretation of these laws is always, you know, a big question. And that's what the judge was forced to do, was to try and interpret the anti-terrorism measures that are in place. But why it's not listed, I don't know. The U.S. listed the IRGC in 2019. The U.S. position was that basically the Iranian regime uses the IRGC as a kind of a tool of statecraft, that its involvement in terrorism is foundational and institutional, I think are the terms they use. But, you know, Canada's been reluctant to do that. There may be good reasons for that. We're not entirely sure what they are. But the normal listing process would be for these groups to come up through the intelligence and security services in Canada, the RCMP or CSIS in particular, who would recommend a group for listing, and then it would go to cabinet. But as I said before, the Quds Force has been listed in Canada for the past 10 years, but not the IRGC itself.
Has the government said anything since this ruling from the judge? Are they going to abide by it? Are they going to make the change? Are they going to fight it? I don't even know how that would work.
The government hasn't really responded directly. The Minister of Public Safety was asked pointedly about this. You know, will you abide by exactly the question you asked? Will you follow the ruling? But didn't really answer directly. The government's response has been sort of just to list off all the other things that they're doing to target the IRGC. So no, we don't know, you know, exactly. It sounded like they didn't intend to follow up on this or to adopt it as policy, I guess. And they seem to feel that the measures they've been putting in place, even in the last few months, there's been a ramp up of pressure on the IRGC, but they seem to feel that that's adequate without listing the IRGC itself.
You mentioned that you don't know specifically, and the government hasn't said anything. What motivation might they have for not doing this already, especially since, as you mentioned, the United States has had this for a few years now?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it may be because the government views the IRGC as a state military force, as opposed to, you know, a terrorist organization that, you know, that you might think of as sort of Al-Qaeda, that kind of thing. And so it prefers not to go down the road of including within its list of terrorist entities groups that are arguably the military forces of countries.
Right.
And, you know, there are provisions within Canadian law that do allow exemptions for state military forces. So it's possible that the government has legal advice from its Justice Department that it's best not to list the IRGC because it's arguably, you know, a military force, as is the Canadian Armed Forces. You know, that's a debatable position, given, you know, the IRGC's origins, that it's just sort of the militia defending a revolution. But whatever reason, that seems to be the path that the Canadian government has taken.
What do we know about the politics of this? Has the government faced calls in the past to include them, as you kind of alluded to? And if so, by who? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of if everybody's on board with this and the government is the holdout, or if this is, you know, a healthy debate taking place in Ottawa.
Yeah, I mean, the House of Commons itself passed a motion in 2018 calling on the government to list the IRGC. So in that sense, it's kind of nonpartisan.
Okay.
But, you know, as you point out, I think terrorist designations are tricky and politically charged. It's also debatable what they accomplish beyond signaling that certain groups are considered terrorists in Canada's books. But on the other hand, you know, it is an important signal. It's important for Canadians and the world to know who we define as those involved in terrorism. And in this case, it's another way of upping the pressure on the IRGC at a time that it's engaged in, you know, an expanded array of atrocities. You know, we've listed out some of the things they've done. They, in addition to, you know, the crackdown that they've done within Iran itself, you know, the IRGC is basically the financier. They do the training of groups that are also quite hostile to Canada's interests, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Taliban. So, you know, this is obviously an organization that I think the Canadian government would have issues with. I think the debate is simply, what's the best way, you know, to pressure Iran and the IRGC into changing, reforming their behavior? And is the listing process the right tool to use against that? And I think there are factions within Canada that believe it is, the opposition, Jewish community in particular, has been very vocal on this issue. The government seems to be saying that they haven't said it outright, but we can kind of interpret from their actions that they don't believe this is the correct tool to use in these circumstances.
You mentioned the Jewish community has been particularly vocal. There is a large Iranian-Canadian population in this country. Do we know what they feel? I imagine that it could get complicated given impacts this could have on people back home for them.
Yeah, I mean, the Iranian community is not uniform in any way. It's the same with the Jewish community, but right. There are, you know, there are elements within it that support the listing, particularly those that are more on the anti-regime side. The downing of the passenger plane 2 years ago was certainly impetus to list the IRGC, and you know, whether or not that particular crime is an act of terrorism or just a sign that the IRGC is completely incompetent is another debate. But listing an organization, any organization, can sometimes drag in innocent people and make their lives more complicated. And, you know, that's possible. That's another factor the government's considering as it weighs whether or not this is the right thing to do.
The last thing I want to get at, and it's one of the reasons we wanted to cover this story, is because there's kind of a larger precedent here. And I gather from your reporting, you've spoken to some national security experts on this. What do they say about this ruling? And more importantly, what should the criteria be? And is there any, you know, uniform criteria you can apply to groups like this that would help Canada classify terrorist and non-terrorist entities?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a big existential debate, isn't it? Like, who's a terrorist and is it a matter of perception? This, you know, terrorist versus freedom fighter kind of issue. It's actually not that difficult to define a terrorist. It's, you know, a terrorist is somebody who engages in terrorism. So organizations that use terrorism as a tactic to advance their goals are, by definition, you know, terrorists. And the criteria that spell out what is terrorism is actually quite clear in the law internationally as well as within Canada. So at the same time, I think as we said, there is an element of signaling that goes on when you talk about terrorism. There's political sensitivities and foreign policy priorities that can weigh into it. It is a minefield when you go out and try and label certain organizations. I mean, some are obvious. I mean, Al-Qaeda, that kind of thing. I mean, that's its essence, is conducting terrorism to achieve its goals. But when you branch out into other groups that may be sort of terrorists / rebels, militias, government, you know, aligned forces. We had the same debate over Hezbollah, frankly, 20 years ago, when this was the Karachan government at the time. They were reluctant to label Hezbollah a terrorist entity. They wanted to label only what they called the militant or the terrorist wing of Hezbollah. And, you know, there was a debate over that at the time, quite similar to this. And they arrived at the conclusion that there was really no way of separating the so-called armed wing of Hezbollah from the larger organization, that they were really inseparable. You know, that's the same debate we're kind of going through right now. Right. Hezbollah is a little different in their, you know, they're not, at least at that time, they weren't so closely aligned with the government. Even now, they're more of an external force. But yeah, I mean, it does raise questions, and it's a debate that's probably going to go on forever. You know, who is a terrorist?
And in the meantime, I'll finish with just a practical question. Given that the judge has made this ruling, kind of whether or not the federal government has come out and said they'll abide by it or not, does that mean that under this precedent, somebody could right now freeze funds that are related to the IRGC? Like, is that allowed to happen as we're speaking?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I can't predict what's going to happen. But I mean, often what happens in Canada is it's up to individual, say, businesses or financial institutions or whoever to make a decision as to whether or not they want to deal with somebody or an organization, or somebody that's affiliated with an organization. And I think the tendency is to be overly cautious, probably for good reason. Say you're a bank and you suspect that somebody's trying to open an account or move money, and that person is you think is associated with a terrorist group, the easiest path is just to say no. So, you know, this may add additional concerns for institutions like that that may decide they don't want to deal with certain individuals or organizations. But, you know, as I say, in all of these things, it's a matter of interpretation. And the government puts out these lists and, you know, passes various sanctions and things like that. To a large extent, it's up to institutions and people to decide how they interpret them.
Of course.
So I think, you know, I mean, the short answer is we're just going to have to wait and see.
Stuart, thanks for walking us through this. I know it's complex, but I understand it a bit better now.
Thank you very much.
Stuart Bell is an online journalist for Global News. That was the big story. I am delighted to announce something I've promised you guys for a while. If you listen to this podcast in Apple Podcasts, or if you would like to, you can now subscribe to The Big Story Plus. What is that? Well, first and foremost, it is an ad-free feed. We know that a lot of you have written into us asking why there are so many commercials on this podcast, and the answer, of course, is because we want to keep our jobs. But there is another way. If you would like to support this podcast directly, you can do so in Apple Podcasts by subscribing for $4.99 a month or just $39.99 for the entire year. You will get every single episode of this podcast with zero ads. You will also get bonus content, whether that's behind the scenes stuff or episodes that didn't quite make the cut for the main feed or some special and okay, sometimes self-indulgent episodes that the producers won't let me do, like talk about sports or video games. I would love it if you wanted to give it a try, because everybody who supports the podcast directly helps keep us going. That said, I want to make sure that everybody listening here for free understands The Big Story is a Canadian news podcast. We will never put any of our 5 weekly episodes behind this paywall. We want you guys to hear the stories that we tell, and we'll make sure that you continue to get that for free. Every single day, you just get to listen to ads. But if you would like The Big Story ad-free and a few fun extras thrown in, you can subscribe to The Big Story Plus on Apple Podcasts. That's all I have to say about that. I know some of you have been waiting for this, so please enjoy. You can find The Big Story everywhere, including Apple Podcasts and at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. And of course, call us. Leave us a message, 416-935-5935. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.